listening in Kenosha for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show.
Before we get to Tuesday's morning show, we want to remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. And if you would like to listen to the morning show in its podcast format, you are welcome to do so. And in doing so, you can hear a different morning show 7 days a week. You should look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg and subscribe. It is available through all of the major podcast platforms, including Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. Again, be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today's program is coming up in just a moment. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, both related to the COVID-19 pandemic and what it was like to be a medical doctor during that incredibly challenging time. Part one is a brand new interview about a brand new book. Part two will come from the morning show archives. Here's part one. We are looking back at the most difficult days of the COVID-19 pandemic through the eyes of someone who was very much on the front lines, a medical doctor by the name of Daval Desai. He was working at the time at a large hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. And his account of what it was like to endure the crushing burdens that he and his colleagues were facing during that time told in a very honest and frankly fascinating book, which is titled Burning Out on the COVID Front Lines, A Doctor's Memoir of Fatherhood, Race, and Perseverance in the Pandemic. My guest, Dr. Daval Desai, has written with disarming honesty about the challenges that he faced, the frailty that he experienced, in a sense, vulnerability, and also the fact that he was experiencing all of this while also was also into the mix of what he and others were experiencing in early 2020 and beyond. And the book is a very powerful account of what those days were like. And I'm so glad to have this opportunity to speak with the author about his book, published by McFarland and Company, again titled Burning Out on the COVID Front Lines. I want to begin with something that I'm curious to see if this is your experience or not. I, from time to time, find myself really consciously thinking back to the most difficult days of the pandemic and what it was like for me in this job at the radio station, in my other job teaching at a local college, what it was like in terms of buying groceries or eating out, or the sense of isolation, what church felt like, what all kinds of things felt like. And invariably, when I think back, I feel like I'm thinking back to a time long, long ago. It feels as distant to me as when I think back to my college experience, which is nearly 40 years ago. I wonder, for somebody like you, and particularly through the course of writing this memoir, do the most difficult days of COVID feel like something from the distant past? Or because you experienced those days very differently than most of the rest of us did, is it still, in a sense, very immediate and part of, in a sense, the immediate past for you?
That's a really good question. You know, at times it feels like it was yesterday, and there's times it's kind of weird time in space where it feels just like you. It felt like it was distant, sort of distant to the point where it's, oh my goodness, did this really happen? Did we really go through this? You know, in the era of smartphones, for better or worse, you know, we have two children, my wife and I, so we take a lot of pictures day in and day out. But during the journey, especially in those first minutes, never with an intent to actually share that, but really, I think I was marking the moment in time. And I really didn't realize how powerful those images would be for my memory until looking back on it, writing, and reflecting on it. So it's a weird mix of time where it feels long ago, but at many points it feels like it was yesterday. And it's something that I think we all need to remember happened a very short time ago. And if and when a situation like this happens again, I'm hoping that we'll be more ready and more prepared to march forward.
Did anything in particular prompt you to want to write this memoir about those difficult days? And what was it like to relive those difficult days?
It was more that I wanted some, and there's people that want to hear it, whether it's just general medical information or perspective. I realized that there's a room for our voice. And I was looking away, how do I share my voice and my story? Because what I went through with all the chaotic intersections from second child being born 2 weeks before the country shut down, leadership crises, being a COVID leader as well as a frontline physician, my own mental health and burnout journey, dealing with racism in the South, the twin pandemics of racism and COVID. I mean, it was wild. And I realized that if I were going through all of this, then I think many others also were too. And the best way I could do that is write. Now, writing didn't happen overnight for me. It was a 2-year journey. I really wrote in chunks. And I really, part of it was, you know, very free-flowing. It was very easy to write. Other parts were really uncomfortable, like, oh, I cannot believe that happened and what we were going through. It just took me back in that time and that moment of stress and kind of the bad place I was in personally and then a lot of us were in personally. And it was hard, but I'm hopeful it'll be a powerful read, not only for healthcare workers, but for others too.
You were not only a medical doctor, but a medical doctor in a position of leadership. Can you just specify that for us? Exactly what was the nature of your position and your responsibilities?
Absolutely. I lead a group of hospitalists or inpatient physicians, about 30 of us. And I was the one disseminating information from one source to another, back and forth to each other, and also advocating for us. You know, I talk about this in the book, but we had a secret stash of PPE or personal protective equipment that we were, you know, kind of hiding out in our office in case the supply even got worse. Yes, the systems we worked for had every best intent to protect us, but it really at times felt like every man for themselves, and our group had to be protected. I had to communicate with my group. I don't think there was a thing such as over-communication, whether it was good, bad, ugly news that I had to say. There was frequent and often communication, which led me to be very connected to my device. I was oftentimes holding my newborn in one arm and holding my phone in the other, voice texting, emailing, on a Zoom meeting, what have you. So there was a lot of constant on switch for me. It was a privilege leading the group. Don't get me wrong. I don't resent any of that. But it was also got to a point about 6 months in where I said, you know, the adrenaline is waning for me. All of this leadership, all of the things I'm doing, this responsibility, trying to fix things that are not fixable at times, it was a journey for me. And I realized I had to really back down and really focus on myself. I didn't leave any of my leadership positions, but I learned to set boundaries and really focus on myself, which has still continued to be an ongoing journey, but it's something that I went through.
Right. One of the moments, I mean, first of all, you are very honest about the depression and anxiety and so on that you experienced and the burnout. And you, of course, rightly talk about the stigma that is attached to that, particularly when somebody is, for instance, a medical doctor. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. I appreciate your honesty about that. I also appreciate your honesty that, in a sense, is at the other end of the scale. This is in chapter two, which is titled Surge. And you write at one point, "One evening while I was changing my son's diaper, my phone rang. I answered on speakerphone, talking with a colleague about a COVID scenario. As the baby cried in the background, Yogita came in, offering help and rescue, but I gave her a nod that all was okay. I just finished putting a fresh onesie on my son when she smirked and said, 'Part of you just loves this, don't you?' 'Love what?' I questioned. 'This pandemic and everything you're doing.' I looked down at my baby boy while he wriggled and squealed, and I giggled, adamantly shaking my head. The truth was, I did enjoy the exhilaration this brought. I truly felt at work." And you go on to say, "This was a moment in time when society began to look at healthcare workers as healthcare heroes. It felt, in your words, strangely rewarding." I so appreciate that. And as someone who was teaching at a college at the time and having to learn all kinds of different ways to do things, I understand and share your sense of strange exhilaration in the midst of a moment that, of course, was so terrible. And I'm so glad that you talk about that aspect of this for you.
Yeah, it was, because it was kind of an opportunity to lead and mark history and say, this is something that may never happen in my career again. And I'm in the center leading this. And we have this whole country and society that are rooting for us. How enabling is that? How powerful is that? This is a historic virus, a pandemic, a historic situation. And feeling needed and that positive support, it was very validating. And the truth be told, I did. I liked it. It was fun. But I didn't realize the toll it was taking subtly until it became not so subtle about 6 months in, when one day my four-year-old at the time just wanted me to teach her how to ride her bike without training wheels. We'd been working on that, but after work, I got home and it was still summertime, hot, sunny, blaring sun, and she just dragged me out there and I said, I have to do this. And yeah, she did a few pedals without training wheels, and I talk about this in this book, but at that moment, I remember faking it. I felt no joy, no excitement. I just could not separate my mood from any of it. And I knew something was wrong at that point. I mean, how can I not, in the moment, enjoying this?
Right. I'm so glad that you offer that sort of explanation or definition for what you were experiencing, because, although I've certainly read about this and known something about it, probably experienced it myself, I don't think I ever understood it as well as when I read this passage when you first described that. As you write, "I was experiencing the all too familiar symptoms of burnout that I had not yet come to fully recognize. More and more, I felt closed off from simple pleasures." And yeah. I think that is such an interesting phenomenon. At another point, you talk about how when you would experience these kind of feelings in their worst, you would talk about going into the basement. Tell us more about the basement.
The basement, then the so-called the basement that exists in my brain. I went to a leadership conference several years ago, and they taught me the psychological term of being in the basement. So when we're stressed, when we're put ourselves in these positions, when we're reacting to email angrily or a text message angrily, we're just not in the right mindset. We need to, our mind is shifted into the basement. And when we're in the basement, we really are taught we should never react and never act upon ourselves when we're in the basement. But what I found is I was headed more and more into this basement, this dark place where my mind was really struggling to come out of. All I could think about is doom and gloom. Daily life just felt like a rut, me holding my infant did not feel, I felt joy. Of course, I love my children and that's wonderful. And but I didn't feel what I know I should have felt. And that was disheartening to me. And that was a problem. My wife noticed it too. And I'm grateful that I had enough insight at that point to realize, something is wrong.
The things that is quite interesting is one of the most difficult moments when you and your doctor agreed for that a change in your medication was important, and you had to taper off your old prescription and start and then in turn begin taking the new. You write, sounds easy, right? No, wrong. This process, which took 2 to 3 weeks, was the most challenging for me ever, physically and emotionally. And it's just kind of intriguing to think about someone who is a medical doctor, nevertheless, in a sense, being blindsided by how difficult this was.
Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't sure I was going to even share that when I started writing the book. But when I started really delving into the mental health aspect, I realized, you know what, if I went through that, countless patients must be going through that. We really just want, I wanted to talk about it. There was nothing off the table at that point. I liked the way you said blindsided. I was blindside effects. And it really gave me a newfound respect for what our patients go through. And I'm better, you know, hopefully a better doctor now, because I will prepare my patients better when this time comes when they need it. You can still be highly functional. You can still be a doctor, a leader, doing what you're doing while you're undergoing treatment changes for all of this. And so many of us in this medical field have a stigma associated with it because we are frankly scared of the repercussions that could come with this. Is it going to affect my licensure? Is somebody going to think I'm not? The answer is no. You know, I talk about in the book the Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation. Dr. Breen was an ER physician who committed suicide in 2020 after serving in a busy ER in New York City. Brilliant physician, brilliant lady, and her life ended so tragically. And when I read her story in the summer of 2020, I was never suicidal, but reading her story, it just jarred me and it rattled me, saying, you know, this could be any one of us. Because the way her journey happened and on the front line, that, you know, dealing with what she dealt with, it was just eerie. So her family has started this foundation, which is an amazing organization, all focusing on destigmatizing mental health for all healthcare workers, not only doctors, focusing on the joy in practicing and all the advocacy that goes along with that. So I'm excited to be giving back all of my author proceeds from this book.
Fantastic. I know we're just about out of time, but I need to be sure to ask you about one other matter that you explore in your book, and I know it is important to you, and it should be important to us. The second chapter of the book is actually titled Twin Pandemics, and in this you explore the way in which you saw systemic racism having a very powerful impact in terms of who was contracting COVID, who was most vulnerable to contracting it, who was finding difficulty in accessing the care that they needed. It sounds like this was a very, very troubling revelation for you in the moment and even now as you reflect on it.
Troubling for sure. You know, it was the murder of George Floyd sparked so much social unrest. And the pandemic, you know, racism has been around obviously a very long time and it still is. But during that time, the twin pandemic, as it was called, is, you know, it's very true. And we felt those tensions. I felt those tensions. I saw a disproportionate number of minority patients being admitted with coronavirus who just did not either know how to do mitigation strategies before a vaccine, advocate for themselves. I mean, the list goes on. And we know it's well documented. There are many inequities in outcomes of minority patients, especially African-American patients, Latinx patients. So it was a, you know, as much as I always touted myself as being equal and advocate for all, certainly there was opportunity because this healthcare system is so complex. The other part is I have vitiligo, which is a deep pigmentary skin disorder. So I have gone from a complexion of brown transformed to white. And it's not something I was always comfortable talking about, but I am now. But it was during this journey also that, you know, I realized that patients often ask me, well, Desai, that sounds Indian, but you don't look Indian. Why? And I don't ever explain it because I never want it to be a distraction of what we're talking about. But it was just kind of a wake-up call saying, well, are patients expecting me to be acting different, looking different, be a different type of doctor if I look brown versus I look white? What are the expectations? And, you know, I cannot ever put myself in the shoes of an African-American patient or an African-American physician because I don't know what they experience based on skin color, but it just woke me up saying that, okay, you know what? When first thing people notice is skin color. And a lot of times we have biases and assumptions with that. So it was a big wake-up call for me, a reflection for me. And I reflect on that and, you know, narrate that about in the book. And it's a lifelong journey, but it's an important one.
How are you doing today? I mean, I guess, are you bearing any enduring scars from all that you experienced?
Scars, of course. I think there's scars from this. I would say yes. Is it scarring to the point where I am dysfunctional? No. But the scars are there in a way for me to make a message out of it. And that's one of the things I'm hopeful the book will be, hopefully for generations to come, is that it's okay to not be okay. It's okay to be vulnerable. You can still be functional. You can still be a wonderful doctor despite struck classic facade for so many of us. So I want to open up that dialogue, but I'm doing much better. It is a journey, and I'm doing everything I can to take care of myself and being better about setting boundaries and focusing on family and, you know, standing by the idea that mental health is health.
Very good. As you write so well at one point, healthcare workers on the front line of a pandemic have a unique and powerful perspective. And you've certainly shared that in your marvelous book. Again, it's titled Burning Out on the COVID Front Lines, A Doctor's Memoir of Fatherhood, Race, and Perseverance in the Pandemic. It is published by McFarland and Company. Dr. Deval Desai, thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing this important story. And to finish out today's morning show here on WGTD, we're going into the morning show archives to replay an interesting conversation that I recorded back in November of 2020. That was during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic and during one of the really frightening surges that occurred during that period. The conversation you're about to hear was with my sister, Dr. Rondi Berg, who works for the Gundersen Health System. And she was and remains a doctor at a small clinic in Harmony, Minnesota, and also is the lead physician for a small nursing home there. And nursing homes, of course, were in so many respects right on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. And it was an incredibly stressful and challenging time for everybody involved in that particular kind of care. So here is that conversation that takes us back to November of 2020. With my sister, Dr. Rondi Berg. Rondi Berg, Dr. Rondi Berg, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've talked several times before, although I think the last couple of times it has not been about anything related to your work as a family practitioner, as a medical doctor. Let's just start with a summary so people understand the kind of doctor that you are and the nature of your particular practice, because I have a feeling it's a little bit out of the ordinary, a little bit uncommon. Explain exactly.
People to the hospital. I rely on colleagues in La Crosse and also in Rochester and Decorah to admit people who need to go into the hospital. In addition to that, I'm also currently acting medical director at three different, adds a whole different layer of worry and complexity to my work. So those are the ways that I spend my time: outpatient medicine in a clinic, usually with full schedules, and then also balancing the work of helping to care for.
How difficult was it for you and your colleagues and counterparts in terms of trying to contend with this with probably a somewhat limited understanding of COVID-19 and with some of the scarcity of certain resources that we in the general public heard so much about?
Yes. So you may be referring to the shortage of PPE or personal protective equipment that was really kind of the scourge of our existence early on in the pandemic and is still an issue, but fortunately seems to be less of a problem currently. But in those early days, yes, that was one of the things that we dealt with on a daily basis. And you might recall that initially community members were advised not to acquire. Now know that you know, everyone is encouraged to wear whatever forms of PPE, usually meaning homemade fabric masks or masks that they acquire through other means, that's a part of what we recommend as just a daily routine. So, yeah, that was a big part of the early day. We had weekly updates through our headquarters in La Crosse, where we were absolutely glued and hanging on every word, you know, taking in every little bit of information that that was known or becoming known.
Right.
I would say one of the biggest differences that I've noticed from the earlier days of the pandemic compared to now has been a shift in the attitude of patients who come into the office. So that early on in late March and April, if I were to ask someone, do you have any questions about COVID? Do you, you know, have any questions about how to protect yourself or your family? It was not at all uncommon. It happened several times a day that the person would just immediately blow up and would go on and on about, you know, oh, this is all a hoax. This is, you know, not real, and I don't want to hear anything about it. And, you know, you just kind of quietly move on. But I will say that now over the past couple or even few months, that has greatly shifted, so that now whenever I ask someone, you know, do you have any questions about how to protect yourself or your family or the symptoms to look for with COVID, they're very receptive to the question. Usually the answer is, I hear about it all day, and I feel like I need to know. But a big shift just in attitude and response to that question.
Wow. So just to be clear, what you're talking about is when you would be talking about a patient where there is no direct connection to COVID. I mean, it's not somebody who thinks they have COVID or you're wondering if they have COVID. It's just kind of a general question about well-being and staying safe, and that early on you had a lot of patients not particularly interested and or not very receptive to even the notion of hearing about COVID, and that has changed a lot. And I should think you are happy about that. My wife Kathy has a very good friend who I don't remember now exactly what she does. I want to say a nurse practitioner, but I don't think that's correct, actually, but somebody who works in a hospital here in the area. And at a couple of different points, and particularly early on in the pandemic, she was talking a lot about shifting protocols. And at certain times she's worked, for instance, in the ER, and protocols would change. I mean, from this date to maybe 2 weeks later, the protocols would have completely changed because of new information. Can you just kind of give us a sense of just how drastically this shift in information and changing in protocols has happened over this period? And has any of that settled down? I mean, are we in a period now where we are in a little more sort of solid state of understanding COVID and how it is spread and how to deal with it? Or is this still as much an evolving situation as it was a few months ago?
Right. So I can't necessarily know the specific protocols that she's talking about.
Of course.
But as one example of the type of protocol that initially was shifting by the day sometimes, is that we would have, and still do to some degree, a tiered system of how to prioritize who can get tested, how quickly that result comes back, and so on. And earlier in the pandemic, there were definitely people who, you know, in a lot of ways were very deserving of being tested, but who simply didn't fall into one of the tiers that would allow them to be tested. And just to give an example of that, I had a call from someone who had a brand new grandchild who had been born several states away and wanted to visit, but the reasonable request. But there was no place in that tiered system where there was an allowance for that. And it was absolutely considerably easier to get tested, certainly if you have symptoms, but even if you don't, if you've had an exposure and are wondering if you might be one of those ubiquitous asymptomatic infected people, there seems to be much better access to testing.
We're speaking in this portion, practices medicine actually in southern Minnesota, in Spring Grove and Harmony. And her practice also includes overseeing three different small nursing homes. And I'd like to talk for a moment about that. And of course, everybody listening understands that we are talking about an especially vulnerable sector of the population when it comes to COVID. And I remember getting a text from you at one point in one of many discussions we've had about COVID where you said something to the effect that, well, you know, and when COVID, you know, enters one of our nursing homes, and it wasn't if, but when, it just sort of floored me and saddened me to think of working in a situation where something really scary also felt all but inevitable. I believe these three nursing homes have been spared any really serious widespread outbreaks, although correct me if I'm wrong, but give us some sense of what it is like to be working with patients in these kind of settings and what can be done to keep these patients as safe as possible.
Yes. Nursing homes as residents as opposed to patients. And that's simply because the nursing home is their home, and that's where they reside. Hmm. Kind of in recognition of that fact, that we really are entering their home when we go into their room or otherwise interact with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenge to keep the nursing home population safe, and there are a number of I don't know what you'd call them, maybe firewalls in place to try and help keep the pandemic out. And that ranges everywhere from screening workers as they come in, certainly screening with temperature checks and screening for symptoms and so on, but also through what we call point prevalence testing. And that's where everyone who works for the facility and the residents periodically are tested just to make sure that we're catching anyone who might be asymptomatic and yet carrying the virus. Keeping residents largely in their rooms, minimizing or sometimes stopping altogether, people from the outside coming in, and that might be something as simple as the person who does their hair. There are times when that can't be allowed. Certainly, everyone is well aware of grave restrictions on visiting in person, which has also been so difficult for everybody. It's a particular challenge when you have nursing home residents who may have an element of dementia, and that can make it very difficult for them to understand or appreciate the importance of staying within their room or not wandering into a neighboring residence area. It's complex to say the least. And I do count myself fortunate not to have had to deal with any of the large outbreaks that so many nursing homes have faced. But that's not to say that we've been spared altogether.
One of the interesting shifts through this pandemic, it seems to me, is that there is a little bit of turning away from certain things that we were really fearful of in the early going, particularly an obsession with or preoccupation with the cleaning of surfaces for out of fear of picking up the pandemic in that way, of picking up the virus in that way, I should say. And and now there seems to be increasing understanding that that really this is caught in the, transmitted in the air, through the air, and it is the air we breathe that we need to be most mindful of, and so on. Is that a fair summation? And I wonder to what extent that shift in understanding has changed the way you are, first of all, practicing medicine and keeping your residents safe, and even when it comes to your own home and your own family and yourself, in terms of keeping yourself safe from COVID-19.
Right. So what you're referring to is something called fomite transmission, where the virus might stick to surfaces or particulate matter or what have you, and then be picked up by touching that surface. And that is thought to be less of a player in transmitting COVID, thankfully. I wouldn't say that it's really changed how we conduct things in the office. Regardless, we are still going to, you know, wipe things down after every visit. We're still going to be, you know, washing our hands faithfully and frequently throughout the day, and liberal use of hand sanitizer and so on. So I really can't say that that has changed, and nor do I see it changing in the are around each other in this home space. I mean, there was a time early on when just someone sitting on a couch and putting their hand up, you know, onto the armrest of the couch, and I'd make a mental note about, okay, better, you know, wipe that down or what have you. And really, it just was something that you could about drive yourself out of your mind with.
When you visited recently, you actually shared a term with me that I had not heard before, but in theater. And it is a phenomenon in which people become needlessly obsessive with some of these kind of practices that we've just been talking about. And not that they have no worth whatsoever, but it is possible for them to... do you see a lot of hygiene theater? I mean, you want to explain that term?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that that is happening in the medical setting, in the sense that it's necessary sanitizing that's happening. It really is a term that's referred more, you know, to other situations. So, you know, someone who goes to fill up with gas and they first wipe down, you know, with a Clorox bleach wipe, the entire apparatus for dispensing gas, and then fill up their tank, and then, you know, wipe down the touchpad before entering their PIN number and what have you. You know, that really just doing what you need to do, grabbing the gas nozzle thing and filling up with gas, and then afterwards doing one thorough, you know, sanitizing of your hands, that would be, you know, likely be sufficient. But it's maybe a little bit of a more exaggerated example, but that's what I mean by hygiene theater. And the danger of it is not so much a matter of overkill, but rather the directing of resources into activities that, you know, may be somewhat futile, that money and supplies and so on could be directed into more high-risk situations.
Right. Well, and of course, it also could be a potential distraction from what matters most, which is keeping your distance and being masked. And are we pretty firmly set scientifically that the wearing of masks really and truly does make a difference?
Well, so I'm only one voice, and there may be other voices that would speak differently. I would say that yes, there is no doubt that it helps. The degree to which it helps could be argued. I get out of my car and the mask is immediately on, even if there isn't anyone around me, and I go about doing, you know, whatever errand I'm needing to do or what have you, and that mask is on my face the entire time and doesn't come off until I'm back in the car. I would say, though, that the things that make the most difference are avoiding gatherings in the first place. If you do gather, to do it outside whenever possible, and if that's not possible, to make the indoors as much like the outdoors as you possibly can, with good ventilation and so on, to keep you know, the other day we needed to gather for a particular purpose, and we did it with, we were a good 10 to 12 feet apart, and everybody wore masks, and we were outside the entire time. And we had a really enjoyable time. So, you know, some of it is about learning how to enjoy each other's company in new and creative ways. I think this Thanksgiving, for example, we're planning on doing an outdoor bonfire and probably do that at Christmas too and sing carols around the fire. And we just have to figure out new ways. And those new ways can be beautiful and enjoyable. They will just be different.
Right. Very well said. Dr. Rondi Berg, my sister, I am so happy to have you back on the morning show. Thank you for all that you have shared today, and thank you for your good work on behalf of all of your residents and patients. Take care. Stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
This preceding interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in November of 2020. And again, part one of today's morning show featured Dr. Dhaval Desai, the author of his memoir, Burning Out on the COVID Front Lines, a doctor's memoir of fatherhood, race, and perseverance in the pandemic. Tomorrow on the morning show, an interview with writer and journalist Max Marshall, talking about his latest book, Among the Bros, a fraternity crime story. This is a troubling and interesting true story of essentially a crime circle, a drug trafficking ring, which emerged out of one of the fraternities at the College of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina. The book is not only an intriguing look at that specifically, but also a look at the day it will be Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. And we'll be talking with Dr. Shannon Faust about the various things that she teaches at UW Oshkosh, and also talking with her about a special class that she is offering to the general public called Connecting with Nature. And it's a wonderful opportunity to get out there in the natural world in some very, very exciting and even beautiful ways. And we'll be hearing about that on Thursday. On Friday, it will be an interview that I just recorded with best-selling author Tom Clavin, who has written about a number of different subjects, but probably his favorite is the Old West, and his most recent book is called The Last Outlaws, The Desperate Final Days of the Dalton Gang. A look not only specifically at the infamous Dalton Gang, but also at what it was like to see the American Old West, in a sense, recede into the past. And looking ahead to Monday, I'm so excited to share with you an interview I just recorded with John Clinch about his wonderful new novel, The General and Julia, which stems from the difficult final days